We are in the final sermon in a series called Excelling in Exile, looking at a book in the Old Testament called Daniel, about a prophet named Daniel. And they're in what's called exile. Daniel and his friends have been taken from their homeland, forced into Babylon to help run a pagan empire. And they are trying to stay faithful to God in the midst of that. They'd rather live their lives a different way, but there's huge restrictions placed on them. And so as we look at this, I'm hoping we navigate, and glean some wisdom in terms of how we as followers of Jesus, if you're a follower of Jesus, to how we live in a society and stay faithful to Jesus that in a culture that doesn't always reflect our Christian principles and values. So to move into today, I want to tell you about an experience I had when I was about 20 years old where I found myself on the top of a cliff. I was on top of a cliff tied with a rope like this person, but it did not look nearly as happy as this person did. If you know me a little bit, if I am about 5 feet off the ground, I'm about 4 feet too high off the ground. I do not like heights. It is not my favorite thing. So I was part of this rock climbing experience, and we were going to do some belaying off this cliff, and it's, 3 or 4 stories high. So I'm leaning, I've got the rope tied up, there's an anchor, and if any of you have ever done this and you like heights, then power to you, but not for me. So I'm on the edge of this thing, and they give me that really helpful piece of advice. The person belaying the line just says, just lean back. That's it. That's all you got to do, right? And that sounds way harder than it actually is in the moment. And then maybe some of you have had this before. When you are rock climbing or you're up some heights or something like this, your legs do this really helpful thing where they start to wobble. And you're like, thanks, nervous system, for making me even more unstable while I'm on the edge of a cliff, right? And as I was doing this experience, I did make it down, but I also started to think, like, who is some of the first people to think, hey, let's tie some ropes to ourselves, hope they hold, and go down this side of a cliff, right? To experiment. Some of the first people to get into rock climbing, get into belaying off cliffs, and be like, yes, the rope can hold 7,000 pounds, but I don't know about today. I'm feeling pretty heavy. I don't know. But I wonder who were the first people to do this type of thing. And some of you have watched reality TV and you've seen activities that people come up with and you're like, wow, that's incredibly dangerous and mesmerizing. And I often wonder who was the first person to think of it and then try it, especially this activity. Some of you have seen this on TV where people will swim with sharks and they'll put their nose on the shark and let them push them through the water. And I was like, who was the first person to think of this and be like, yeah, that's a good idea. I'm going to do that. I'm going to put my hand on this thing that could devour all of my arm and let it push me through the water. And hopefully it doesn't think that my arm is something that needs to be munched. I wonder who comes out, and this is my favorite one, this guy who said, I need to test out this shark suit, see if it actually is shark proof, and put his arm and body parts in a live shark and just hope that the engineers and analysts got it right when they were designing his suit. And there's no crack in his armor. Yeah, it's a good one. It's tough. Why would you want to do this? And be like, okay, I hope that this shark doesn't actually, is stronger than we expected. All of these things involve one thing. When you're doing these activities that are very dangerous and you're doing them maybe for the first time, they involve an element of trust. Trust that the rope will actually hold, that the anchor is secure, that you will make it to the bottom in one solid piece. And trust that the sharks will not decide to chew your hand off when you touch them. First of all, you're swimming with sharks to begin with. I don't want to do that ever, let alone, I don't even want to pet like those 4 feet dog sharks that don't bite at all. Like, I don't want to be near them. But some people will have this element where they can trust that this thing will not bite them. And even if they are wearing this armor, that it will not bite through their armor and take off their arm or leg or head in the process. It's this element of trust. Trust defined as simply a belief in the reliability of something or someone, a strong belief in that. When we trust someone, we often listen to their advice. We act on it. We act in faith, and we allow, our trust is allowed to build and grow in that advice or that person. For example, when you act in faith on somebody gives you some advice, and it turns out or they were accurate, your trust builds, it fills up a little bit more. There is an example of this being like, say you go to your doctor and they say, hey, your blood pressure and your cholesterol a bit high, I need you to start moving more. I need to start being a little more active. If you put faith in their advice and you put faith in that they are an expert in human anatomy and they are accurate information for you, then, and if you go and do those things, and yes, you are likely to act on it in faith because you've built up your trust in that. The text that we're looking at today from Daniel chapter 6, is a place where there's momentous trust needed. It's a famous story, many of you are aware of it, Daniel in the lion's den. You've heard it in Sunday school, or you've heard it in other sermons. It's a very, very famous text and a miraculous text where God is on the move and Daniel is acting in trust. So just to catch you up from last week, if you were here or if you weren't, Daniel 5, there's a king named King Belteshazzar who's been overthrown by a guy named Darius. Darius is the leader of the Medes and the Persians. And Daniel was such an impressive leader in the Babylonian Empire, even though he was Jewish, he is kept around under Darius's reign and even put into leadership there as well. So we take it up in Daniel chapter 6. It's up on the screen, or if you have scriptures, you can open it up. Daniel chapter 6, verse 1, where it says this. It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps, think of like a governor or a local ruler or leader, to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. They're management-type people. Now Daniel was so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. Daniel's one of the only people that is mentioned from the old kingdom, the Babylonian Empire, that has just been squashed by Darius, is kept around, put into leadership, and he's so distinguished and good at his job, making sure that the king doesn't suffer loss, that he's actually put into more leadership. He's put into one of the top three people in the kingdom and or he's going to be put over top of them, like the second in command, in charge of the entire kingdom. This is an incredible influence for him, and this is something that God longs for each of us as we go about our daily jobs, our volunteering, our time, that we become so influential in our space that God gives us beautiful responsibility to reflect his love out to the world. But sometimes one success doesn't sit well with other people, right? And Daniel's rising star in this kingdom, and there's a bunch of insiders that go, who is this guy? He shouldn't be part of us. So they set into motion trying to discredit him. They try and slander him. But they can't. Daniel is 80 years old at this point, and he has lived such a life of integrity and character that they cannot find something to discredit him with. So then they finally go after his faith. It says this in verse 5, where it says, finally, these men said, we will never find any basis for charges against this man, Daniel, unless it has something to do with the law of his God. So they go after his faithfulness towards God and say, if we can attack this, then we will have an angle to bring him down. So they go after that, and they first go to the king, and they appeal to his insecure ego in this moment. They go after Darius's ego, and they go, let's make everybody worship you. It says this down in verse 6. It says, so these administrators and satraps went as a group to the king and said, may King Darius live forever. The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or human being during the next 30 days, except to you, pray to Darius, pray to a human, your majesty, shall be thrown into the lion's den. And they want to make this, you know, as they're planning this, they want to make it irrevocable. They say this, now, your majesty, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered. We use the same language today. When there's something legal going on, negotiations, we say, make sure you get it in writing. Put it in accordance with the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be repealed. So King Darius thinks this is a good idea. It's like, hey, everyone gets to worship and pray to me for 30 days. This is fantastic. So he puts the decree in writing. So this is they're working a back channel to try and attack Daniel from this. And Daniel has a beautiful response as soon as he hears about this new law, this decree that's been put in place. It says this, now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened towards Jerusalem, his homeland. Three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. Just as he had done before, Daniel hears of the decree. He knows the implications of it. He is near the end of his life. He's in his 80s. And he does just as he has done before. He goes home. He prays with the windows open, facing Jerusalem, asking for help from the living God. He knew the consequences of this if he was caught. Daniel had a few options. He could have said, okay, I'll just pray to Darius for 30 days. Or he could have said, I'll just pray privately or secretly. Or maybe I just won't pray at all or worship for 30 days. But he chooses to do what he has always done, to pray openly and faithfully to the living God. He lived out this with one of the prayers that were written in the Psalms, where it said, evening, morning, and noon, I cry out in distress, and he hears my voice. And keep in mind, Daniel is the third, one of the top three leaders in the country, and he's about to become the second in command. This guy is busy. He has more staff than any of us in this room will ever have. But he is someone who is taking time to make space and an intentionality to pray and pause and gain wisdom from the living God. And so as you know, as the story starts to progress, you can hear it coming. It says, then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. And they requote to him the law that he has set into place. And they remind him that it's in writing. They cannot change it. Cannot change it at all. And then they say to the king, then they said to the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, your majesty, or to the decree you put in writing. He still prays three times a day. When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel. He realizes he's been set up and made every effort until sundown to save him. So he realizes he's been set up. He wants to stop what's happening, as he's trying to save Daniel, the council reminds him, hey, you put this in writing. You cannot break this. This has to happen. So it says in verse 16, so the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve, continually rescue you. And then the king leaves. They lock it up. They shut it. They close the doors. He implants his ring into it and spots to show that the seal is set and cannot be opened until later. And the king goes home, and he's so worried about Daniel that he actually is up all night. And then in the morning, when the first dawn came, when he came near the den, the king, he called to him, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me because I was found innocent in his sight, nor have I ever done any wrong before you, your majesty. It's this trump card of going, look it, I have been innocent before you, and God has rescued me in the midst of this situation. Daniel knew that when he prayed openly, when he was faithful to God, when his culture wasn't, it could affect him no matter what. There is as we read earlier in another famous part earlier in Daniel, when his three friends were thrown into a fiery furnace, before they were thrown in there for their faith in God, they said, God is able to rescue us. And then they said, even if he doesn't, we will still only worship him. Their faith was strong, and I imagine Daniel had the same mindset that even if I'm thrown into a lion's den, the only one I can worship is the living God. Daniel knew this, that in spite of present circumstances, God was still trustworthy. That in spite of his situation, in spite of his circumstances, that God is the only one that he could actually entrust himself to. Not to man, not to his culture, not to the rulers, not to the leaders. The only person that he could entrust himself to was the living God. In the midst of whatever you're walking through right now, whether you're in a work situation and you're being asked to do something that's unethical and you're not sure what to do, in the midst of that, God is still trustworthy. He is still good. If your thoughts have been haunted by a temptation for weeks or months and you're wondering, should I just give up my standards or my virtues as a follower of Jesus and live out my desires? God is still good, he's still trustworthy, he still loves you, and he still has reasons for having those virtues and principles as a follower of Jesus. If your health situation is bleak and there's things that are ongoing and they restrict you and there's no end in sight, there's not something that's going to just heal it, not an answer or a diagnosis, in the midst of that, God is still good, he is still trustworthy in spite of current circumstances. The king was very excited that Daniel was still alive. It says this in verse 23. The king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him. because he had trusted in his God. Daniel, in spite of his present appearances and his circumstances, knew that God is still trustworthy. Jesus modeled this for us. When he was dying on the cross, he's hung on the cross, he's dying for the sins of the world, for all humanity to experience the healing forgiveness of God. He's about to die, and he says this famous line. It says, Jesus called out with a loud voice, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. When he had said this, he breathed his last. Up until his dying moment, Jesus was entrusting himself to his heavenly Father. Living in pain, knowing that he could stop this at any moment. He was God among us. And in that, he continued to entrust himself to the living God. That in spite of present circumstances and appearances, he knew that is the only place to place his trust. And we have this beautiful promise from the book of Isaiah around what some of the results are of acting in trust with God, where it says this, you will keep in perfect peace those whose minds are steadfast, because they trust in you. Perfect peace, peace that passes all understanding. We're going to shift gears for a moment to do something. I'm going to invite someone from the congregation who's experienced the richness of trusting God this past fall. Now, God has been interacting and rescuing them from their situation. So I'd like you to just and welcome Al Spilda. He's going to come on up and he's going to share with us. And on a side note, I believe Al has also swam with sharks.
Not their noses. Thank you for having me up after the sermon today. I feel humbled, but just wanted to relate to you something that has been going on with me for a while. But in particular, most of you know that I work on the water as a mariner, and I have done that for probably 30, 35 years. I've always had a color deficiency, and I've known that since I was a kid, which makes it difficult for me to get into a number of professions. Being a mariner is one of them. So in the old days, as my granddaughter would say, the thing was it was like the Wild West. If you had the money to buy a boat and you could go out and do that, you were able to just go out in there. Along the way, standards came in, marine medicals got involved, and you know, you start taking your color vision tests, all the different things. Anyways, we'll cut to the part that's the important part for me, because over the years, I've operated at different times with restrictions on my ticket because of my color vision, but back about 1999, I went through what was at that time called the definitive test for color vision, which is used worldwide, which was a lantern test, and I passed it, which then allowed me to carry on and actually get my marine tickets, my captain's tickets, and so on, and move up the scale. Over the years, I had to redo that test again once more in the mid-2000s, 2008, 2007. And then I thought I was going to live out my career without having to go through it. 2017, I get a letter from Transport Canada saying I have to redo my marine medical, my color vision test, because it's out of date. And I just had forbearing about doing that, and I was trying to find different ways. I thought I would be the one that was in control. And for about 2 years, from 2017 until just this fall, I wouldn't say I was fighting with Transport Canada, but I was certainly trying to make it happen my way and not the way that I should have put my faith. And as it happened, I went through all of the things. They give me a couple of options. One was to do a color vision test that was, you can do the ones with the circle dots, which I'm sure you've all done. Everybody's seen those ones. I don't fail them miserably, but I fail them just enough that I don't pass. But there is a second test you can do, which is a color arranging test, which I had done previously once. Of course, I didn't have a clue what I was doing, and I failed that. And the results then go to the medical unit in Ottawa, and they normally make a ruling on it, and away they go. I heard nothing from them for now goes on 16 months. My Marine ticket is coming up for renewal of October this year, and to renew my ticket, I need to have a medical. So it was kind of one of those deals where you finally have to face the music as to what you're going to do. And the music was that I had to redo my lantern test, or I had to do this other one. I redid the Farnsworth test, but had heard nothing from Ottawa. And this was going on. Checked in with Transport Canada in July, said, what do I need to renew my ticket? And they're telling me, okay, well, you got to do this or this. And I said, well, I'm waiting for the Marine unit to tell me, the medical unit, whether I've passed or not passed. Didn't know. As Deb will tell you, all through July, August, and into September, I tried to control everything possible that I could to see how I was going to do this. I was prepared to give up my ticket and go back to having a restriction on my ticket. And at every point, they kept saying, no, you have to do the lantern test. The problem was the lantern tests were no longer in the Marine physician's offices. They now were being conducted by Transport Canada. And the only place in Canada is either in Toronto or in Vancouver. So I had to go to Vancouver. I had just bad feelings about the whole thing. I had to go over the day that I was going over, September the 25th, and got on the ferry early, walked on, got to the office. I was a couple hours early, walked around the block, couldn't bring myself to walk into the building. And I'll tell you what, walking in those front doors was, to me, it looked like the lion's den. And I finally walked away, walked down the block. I think it was probably the park by the courthouse, and I sat there for a while and, you know, just finally said, you know, God, it's in your hands. It's whatever's going to happen is going to happen. And I sort of, it was at that point that I certainly for the first time in months had a little bit of peace. I got up from the park. I walked down the block. I walked in. As I walked in the building into the lobby, my phone rang. And it was the medical unit in Ottawa. And they said, we're just reviewing your case. We're going to rule on it in about 10 minutes. But you make reference that you've done this other color arranging test, and we don't have that on our file. And I said, well, I just happen to have my file with me because I'm going to do my lantern test right now. So I went upstairs to Transport Canada. They faxed the results to Ottawa. And, you know, you might think that was the end of the story. It wasn't.
Nope.
So now my lantern test is delayed. They're having problems setting it up. And I'm asking the gal at the front desk, can you look at my file? Maybe they've ruled on it. Maybe there's something that says I don't have to do this test. No chance. So finally I sit down. I'm delayed. I'm sitting there for about half an hour in the office. And they call me in. I sit down and they turn, you know, in a darkened room. And they turn on this little light. You're supposed to sit 20 feet from it. They turn on the light. And they're asking me the colors. I'm supposed to read the colors. It's nothing. I says, I don't see anything. You're supposed to see these little dots, whether they're red, green, yellow, or white. The next thing, they're looking, and they see nothing. The light's not working. So now, okay, I'm sitting 20 feet away. They say, oh, come here, sit 6 feet away. Looking in, and it comes on, but it's very dim. So then they tell me, okay, wait for a minute. You go out, wait, we're going to reset it up again. This went on 3 times. And then finally they said, you know, we want you to have every opportunity to pass this test. So we're going to put in a notation that the light needs to be sent out for service because it's obviously not working. They knew, and I knew, that what I had seen of the lights, I was doing miserably poor. But they said, come back in 30 days, and we'll have the light service and do that. So I go home, don't know what to make of this. I get home, and I have an email from the medical unit in Ottawa. And this actually is the next morning. And they say, have you a phone number that we can phone to call you? So they phone and they call me. This is like the day after. And she says, you passed. You have no need to do the lantern test. And it was just one of those things, you know, I was dumbstruck. But then it's also the point at which you realize that you have to come back to what you believe sometimes. Sometimes, you know, I'm in a position where I'm used to making decisions. I'm used to sort of seeing what's going on with other people and their lives and so on. So it was very easy for me to try and control my own situation because that's what I'm used to doing. But the lesson for me was that we never can really truly get what we want unless we continue in our faith with God. Mm-hmm. And that for me was the most important lesson that I learned that day. I don't know what he has planned for me in the future. I may never use my ticket again, or I may. It'll be up to him. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Al. I'm going to close with a word of prayer over that, and then we're going to close in song. Join me as we pray. Heavenly Father, I thank you that you are a God who saves, that you rescue us from our sin and our brokenness by dying for us, that we get to live in your empowered love. Not only that, that in the day-to-day ongoings of our life, there are moments of clarity where when we are walking in our surrender and trust towards you, and you move and you act and you do things that are continues to work in each of our lives. I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Please stand as we close in worship.